Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
And I think what we are involved in right now is the reclaiming of our values of equality, justice, cooperation, environmental sustainability, an end to all forms of oppression.
That's the voice of Dr. David Mignelli. On this week's edition of Latin Waves, we interview author and professor Dr. David Mignelli about the roots of the anti-corporate globalization movement and where is it going. Author of the book Another World is Possible, he traces the movement's progress since 1994 and makes a case for the continued development of an anti-capitalist analysis and activism. So stay tuned.
We're very privileged to have David Mignelli. He's our guest. Dr. Mignelli is a professor at York University. He's also an author, the author of Another World is Possible. His interests are globalization and global justice movements, concepts of freedom and democracy in political thought, radical theories of language and culture, Marxism, feminism, and anti-racism, radical political economy. Welcome to our show, Dr. Mignelli. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Sylvia. It's really nice to be here.
History has been set. Capitalism won, and all we have to do now is just kind of tinker with it and make it more humane. Your book presents a different picture. You challenge this idea of free market, as they call it. So let's begin with that. Where does this idea of a free market come from when it seems, according to the statistics you show in your book, that not a single thing moves freely in this society, that there is a huge structure operating behind it? Talk a little bit about it.
Yes, that's a really great point. We talk about free markets as if they are just a sort of neutral territory or a neutral mechanism that distribute goods and services. And the key point I'm trying to make is that markets confer wealth to those who have wealth and power. That's what they do, and they do that very efficiently. If you come to the marketplace as someone with great funds, lots of wealth, lots of political connections, and so on, you will continue to prosper. But if you come as one of the world's billions of poor, laboring people, you will sell your labor. That's the commodity you have to exchange for the goods of life. And that labor will be exploited in an incredibly efficient way by those who have the wealth and power to hire you. And as a result, the market generates inequality. And it generates inequality precisely because it transfers wealth from the laboring poor to those who own the business assets, whether they're multinational corporations, mining firms, agribusinesses, tourism, shopping malls, what have you. And so we need to see the market not as a free mechanism, but as a mechanism that is a very powerful means of transferring wealth from those who work to those who live off the profit from other people's labor.
In your book, you make a wonderful observation that the principal goal of a social justice movement is to develop some type of language, a language that can really articulate our values, our goals. What is it that we're working towards, right? Because it seems to me that the capitalist, this monopoly capitalism, has already devised a great language. They call it globalization is shrinking the world. We're all interdependent in this wonderful relationship of, you know, people come together. Who would be against that, right? Behind the scenes picture is nothing but it's a cultural dependence where ones are being exploited and others are profiting. So how do we create that culture? How do we begin to create language that challenges those ideologies and perhaps challenges our own inherent biases that we are naturally selfish? You know, all of those things that has been so fermented over years of education and inculcation. Where do you begin?
Well, one of the things I think we need always to remind ourselves is that that sort of cultural awakening that you're describing is already happening in parts of the world. Here in the global north, we're lagging behind. But you mentioned the title of my book, Another World is Possible. That, of course, comes out of the World Social Forum movement that begins in the late 1990s and in the early years of this decade, which really was the first great ideological, cultural, and political challenge to neoliberalism, to the idea that that capitalism and capitalism alone could bring prosperity, peace, and freedom to the world. And of course, what we saw instead of prosperity, peace, and freedom was more and more people around the world falling into poverty and hunger. I mean, we had just a year ago another 100 million people fall into the condition that the United Nations calls absolute poverty, where day in and day out, it's not clear that they can feed themselves. So it's not bringing prosperity. It's not bringing peace. We only need to look at the escalation of wars around the world, whether they are the sort of dirty wars being waged in countries like Colombia, where so-called anti-guerrilla movements are being used to drive indigenous peoples and Afro-Colombians and small peasant farmers off their land, on the one hand, or whether it's the much more technologically intensive wars of Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's also not bringing peace. And then on top of that, it certainly isn't bringing freedom. If by that we mean, this is, I think, a key part of the answer to your question, if by freedom we mean the right of people working together in communities around this planet to collectively make decisions about how they produce, what they produce, about building homes, about feeding people, about educating people, about providing health care and child care, making sure the medicines that people need are available. Real democracy means that actual communities of people together plan the production and distribution of all the basic necessities of life. They try to figure out democratic ways of doing that and living together in solidarity as real communities. And so when I said to start this comment that movements articulating this kind of vision have already started to emerge, I'm thinking, of course, in particular of the powerful social movements that have been coming out of Latin America since the mid to late 1990s. And here we can be talking about the Zapatista movement in Chiapas in southern Mexico, or we can be talking about all of the social movements involved with the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela, or whether we're talking about the great cycle of resistance that began in 2000 in Cochabamba, Bolivia, where the mass movement of the people stopped the privatization of their water, and all the way through, of course, to the election of Evo Morales, the fight for indigenous rights, and so on. And one of the things which I find really interesting is if you look at that year 2000 movement in Bolivia against the privatization of water, they called themselves the Coordination for Water and Life. And that idea that we're putting life first, that we're putting the needs of humans and the natural environment in which they live ahead of corporate profit, ahead of the right of a tiny minority to accumulate untold amounts of wealth. And so we're seeing a vision which I would say has some of these elements, a vision emerging that has some of these elements. Participatory democracy, the right of communities to really decide their own affairs, economic justice, environmental justice, indigenous sovereignty and self-determination, gender equality, anti-racism, human solidarity, all of this encapsulated within what people have defined as a globalization from below, not the globalization of the multinational corporations and the banks, but a global linking together of social justice movements into a truly global justice movement. And so we're seeing cooperation, environmental sustainability, indigenous sovereignty, economic justice, human solidarity and cooperation all get knitted together into a new vision. And I think you're right, Sylvia, to say that because the mainstream, because the multinational corporations, their international institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, the dominant governments in the world, they have tried to claim certain values for themselves. And I think what we are involved in right now is the reclaiming of our values of equality, justice, cooperation, environmental sustainability, an end to all forms of oppression. And that's beginning to emerge, but we need to, through all the cultural forms we have, whether it's the work I do, mainly by way of teaching and doing workshops with groups and so on, or whether it's musicians, artists, and so on, and then, of course, the activists who organize our social movements in the streets, we need to bring all of that together and say, we're not just resisting what's going on today. We have a vision, and we have a vision of a new world that is actually possible. It's not just a dream. It is a dream, but it's not just that. It's a dream that we could bring into life because we see it in parts of the world today, and we see it every time communities come together to say we have values of human life, not corporate profit.
Sometimes I think that if we're looking for something, we find what we're looking for. If our framing is to create an alternative to a world of injustice, we find that. If our framing is to continue a world of exceptionism and exclusion, where 1% of the population get to amass incredible wealth at the expense of the majority of billions of people who are starving, then we can find some justification, and we can find a willing, you know, educator or intellectual to write something to justify that. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this need to recreate or I guess to challenge the ways in which we educate ourselves, because I think that our education plays such a huge role in how we promote conformity rather than creative, you know, critical thinking, instead of acknowledging that different alternatives are possible. And just like you point out, Bolivia, you know, 2000 was just like Canada, having governments that acted autocratically, that didn't really listen when we said we want housing, no, we'll have an Olympics party. You know, and in Bolivia was the same thing, but the people have changed that. They now have a constitution that said 50% of the women have to be represented in government, that their budgeting for their cities need to be done participatory, that, you know, the citizens get to participate and decide what kinds of things they need. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of our own challenges that we need to overcome with, as educators, in terms of what is the role of educators?
Yes, and I think that touches on some really important issues, because if we're going to change our society in a meaningful way, that means that the whole process by which education is organized has to be challenged. We are used to a model that children get drilled into their heads and into their behavior from around ages 4 or 5, where their job is to sit and be passive, follow orders, and simply absorb the information that others are trying to cram into their heads. And as you've already hinted at, this doesn't encourage critical thinking. This encourages passivity, obedience, memory learning, but it doesn't create individuals who can think and reflect and analyze, draw on their own life experiences. So one of the things I think we need to do is to challenge that model, to create the notion, if we want a participatory democracy, of participatory learning, that everyone is both teacher and student. Everyone has something to contribute. Everyone has things to learn from others. And so we want to create settings in which people begin to appreciate that their experience of the world matters. They may have lots of half-formed ideas about that experience. They may not have had the opportunity to see how, for example, the homeless people in their community has some connection to child labor in Bangladesh, for instance. Those are the links that very careful and detailed analysis requires. But we have to begin with the local, with the immediate experience that people have, and then start to see what links and connections we can make. What do the tomatoes that appear in our supermarkets in February have to do with migrant farm labor in Southern California, for instance? And so on. So we're talking about using knowledge as a critical tool to unpack our own world, to take the everyday and re-examine it. Because when you start to examine the everyday again in a critical way, you discover all kinds of things about the world around you that are hidden most of the time, that are obscured. Your tomato costs $2 for however many in February, but what about the wages of the workers who are migrants in California, perhaps many of them undocumented, and so on? And it's that process of linking together everyday events which makes knowledge gathering no longer some strange, esoteric, mystifying thing that only a few experts can speak to. It's the ways in which we all share our experiences and then draw links, make connections, build larger, richer pictures of the world in which we live. So I think that's the first thing, that notion of a critical participatory education that begins from people's own experience. And then the second part is to recognize that education happens at least as much outside the classroom as inside. We're trying to break down the barriers between the classroom and the community, the classroom and the street, the classroom and the workplace. And in fact, to show that critical education for social change means also taking the things we're talking about in the classroom and joining with the demonstrations against the Olympics, to use the example that you were just using, and in favor of social housing, or the demonstrations in support of migrant justice and against the conservative government's demonizing of Tamil immigrants who arrived by ship. Linking together our work in the classroom to the work outside the classroom that social justice groups are doing, to have a much wider, all-embracing sense of education for social justice, as I say, which is participatory, which starts with our own experience, which draws larger connections, and then also links up with the self-education that we do as social justice movements when we're in the streets, when we're in the communities, when we're in our places of work, when we're in our schools doing social activism, trying to create a better world. And I think that's really got to be kind of the beginning points for an alternative model of what popular education could be.
You know, sometimes we tend to divide what we do at home as being different from public life. Oh, that's just my job. I just work there. That's not who I am. I'm all of these other things. And I wonder if that's part of the problem, right? If you work in an industry where you mistreat your employees, and then you go home and you're really nice to your wife, and you say, well, I'm a good father, I'm a good person, but you don't connect, you know, this idea that we can live in a society that promotes competition, that promotes stepping over someone to get ahead, you know, all the imagery that we're taught in the corporate world, that, you know, to get ahead, you gotta step over some toes, and that's the way it works. This idea that we're all selfish and there's no goodness. To me, it's something that we learn socially. That is, it's not something that we're born with, you know, naturally know how to be backstabbing or any of those things. So as I was listening to the news this morning, we hear that in Cambodia, 60 garment factories are being closed. Over 200,000 workers are being displaced. And in Canada, I thought about, you know, this story should really mean so much for us, because we are facing an economic downturn. And what do we hear is, you know, cut spending on social services, cuts to education, cuts to things that we really need. So when we don't make those connections, we are bound to support ideas and processes that are sometimes against our best interests. In your book, you talk about this and the ways in which we can get around that. How do we create alternative discourses and alternatives to the ways in which, you know, sometimes this idea of scarcity creates opportunities for corporations who are already concentrating wealth to erode even more of our benefits and our rights as citizens?
Right. Well, let's start with the first point that you raise, which is really, I think, extremely significant, which is that there's nothing inherent in humans that creates the kind of selfish, sometimes outrightly antisocial activity that flourishes in capitalism. If it was so natural then how is it that human beings lived in organized societies for thousands upon thousands of years without capitalism? How is it that most societies organized themselves much more communally, that until capitalism, virtually all societies, huge amounts of property was common, didn't belong to an individual, belonged to the whole community? The existence of common lands, common fields, rivers, forests, and so on, where everybody could hunt, fish, gather berries, where people could go to get the wood they needed for the winter, and so on. So I think your point is really well taken to start off with. We need to challenge the idea that human beings are inherently selfish. What capitalism does is it tries to hammer into all of us, through the school system, through the mass media, through government, through the mainstream political parties, and of course through corporate life, that this is the only way to get ahead and survive. If you want to look after your family, if you want to have security in old age, and so on, you can't be concerned about the needs of others. You can only look after yourself and maybe your immediate family. So I think you're right to get us onto that issue, and we need to counter that by showing that that despite how hard capitalism works to create that culture and to create that mindset, look at how much people actually do try to cooperate, how much they do try to come together. Look at in any community how people try to get together and help one another out with childcare, with when one member of a neighborhood gets sick and people bring them food, offer to help out by getting the groceries, all these kinds of forms of cooperation which people do day in and day out, which we don't value in a capitalist society, which we treat as kind of quirky, incidental things. And yet the reality is, when you talk to most people about what most matters in their lives, it's these acts of kindness between others. It's the love and community that they get in households, neighborhoods, and so on. Most people do not identify with the dog-eat-dog world of capitalism, which undermines human cooperation and solidarity. So that's a really important point that you've raised there. And this then takes us to this next point that you're making about how, in a time of global economic crisis, our leaders are saying to us, we now have to learn to live on less. Our society as a whole is going through these difficult moments. Let's all band together. And I think we always need, when government starts using that rhetoric, which is designed to appeal to our sense of community, I think we always need to say, hang on a minute now. Aren't you the same people who took trillions of dollars to bail out banks when they were in trouble? And now you're telling us that there were trillions of dollars to bail out banks, but we need to cut back on our health care. We need to cut back on our pensions. We need to cut back on social housing programs. We need to cut back on funding higher education so that universities get less accessible to students and so on. How can it be that a society as rich as this can find trillions for the banks, but then turn around and say, now the poor have to pay? Now the ordinary members of our society have to pay for the trillions we used. And what that tells us is it's not a question of the fact that we cannot afford good housing, education, health care, old age pensions, and so on. It's that our system has built into it a set of priorities that undermine communities, that undermine the values that most of us hold dear. Most of us believe that everybody should get the health care they need, regardless of their ability to pay. Most of us feel that the elderly should be taken care of in dignity out of the resources of our society, and so on. So we need to be really challenging the way they suggest all the time that we all must pull together now and say, well, hang on, you don't pull together to help the majority. You use this rhetoric of pulling together as a way to fund bank bailouts. Just like, to use your example earlier, Sylvia, you use that rhetoric to fund the Olympics but not to deal justly with native peoples. You use it to fund the Olympics, but not to deal with the homeless on our streets. And so I think it's always challenging that rhetoric and being clear that people are not inherently selfish, that people really do care about the values of their communities, but at the same time, governments and their mass media have developed very clever, intricate weapons of basically confusing us and playing on our sense of responsibility to our community. We need that sense of responsibility, but we need to recognize when it's being manipulated. It's being manipulated at this time of global crisis. And part of what we are trying to do, I think, as social justice movements, is to articulate a different sense of what it means to be responsible to our community, as opposed to simply being responsible to bankers and multinational corporations.
That's beautiful. Now, Dr. McNally's book, Another World is Possible, Globalization and Anti-Capitalism. Tell us, how can people access your book?
People can access the book, Another World is Possible, Globalization and Anti-Capitalism, is published by Arbeiterring Publishing, and it is distributed as well in universities and so on by Fernwood Books. So Arbeiterring is Arbeiter, Ring Publishing. They're based in Winnipeg. They're a wonderful independent publisher in Winnipeg. And soon I will have out in November a book called Global Slump, dealing with some of the issues we were just getting to about the economic crisis. And it's got the subtitle The Economics and Politics of Crisis and Resistance. And that's coming from PM Press in California, another really great independent critical press. So sure, I hope readers can enjoy those.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. We look forward to speaking with you about Global Slump. That'd be great.
Thanks, Sylvia. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Dr. David McNally. He is the author of Another World is Possible, Globalization and Anti-Capitalism.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.